You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
Even after 100 days since the first case of COVID was discovered in South Africa, we're still near the beginning of this pandemic. And as the president said recently, it's going to remain with us for many more months, possibly years. Professor Shabir Madi said this week it will likely come in four waves and that we have roughly 10 times more infections currently than reported, which means we've probably got over a million people infected with COVID-19. And that's probably good news, as deaths mean that the mortality rate is lower than expected. But try and tell that to someone who's just lost a sister or a father to the disease. Now, the task of dealing with the coronavirus pandemic is like running a marathon and certainly not a sprint. We've got to remain ever more vigilant in practicing those non-pharmaceutical interventions, physical distancing, wearing our face masks and washing our hands, remembering at all times that we're doing this for those on the front lines as much as our loved ones who might be at high risk. And it's a great pleasure to introduce our third guest on the front line, Dr. Sandile Kubeka, who at 27 years old has already done more than most in his short life so far. Welcome to the show, Dr. Kubeka. I believe you became South Africa's youngest doctor when you qualified at age 20, and we'll come to that. You're the youngest of five children, I believe. What was life like for you growing up in Newcastle?
Thank you for the introduction, and thank you for inviting me to be part of this series, Michael. Well, you've just mentioned that I'm the youngest of five siblings. It was quite an interesting way of growing up, because most of them were a bit more older than me. I think when I started school at the age of two, my brother was, I think the next, number four was, I can't remember, it was about 10 years old. So they were all a bit older. And I think that's when I started to, you know, to be more interested, because they were already at school when I started noticing things. So I enjoyed my time as the youngest, because I felt like I always had backup and people, and I always had backup and I always had support. So that is one of the most important things I value about my upbringing. Yeah,
and that family support is so important. And as the youngest of three siblings in my family, one does pick things up a little quicker when you've got older siblings to look up to. But you were, even in that context, exceptional, because you started school at the age of five, you completed matric at the age of 15. How did you manage that?
Well, interesting that you say it's exceptional. I think it's mostly hard work. I think those years when I was at school, I think it was just more of like hard work and determination and putting all that I can do. I did do grade 6 and 7 in 1 year in 2003, if I remember well. But I matriculated at the age of 15. It was fun. I enjoyed school. So that's more than anything.
And which school did you go to?
Well, our primary school was Jobstown Primary School in Newcastle, and I went to Siyamukela High School thereafter, and then I matriculated there.
It must have been challenging always being the youngest in your class. What was it like, and how did you manage always being the junior in the class?
Sadly, it was a challenge, and I was always the youngest, and people would pick on me and most times, and I was bullied quite a lot. I think it was part of growing up, and I learned a lot from those experiences. They made me a better person, and I can certainly assure you now that having gone through the process and everything, I'm a better person, and I think I'm much more able to cope with certain situations because of those experiences.
Well, that clearly instilled a work ethic from a very young age. You then enrolled at UKZN's Nelson Mandela School for Medicine, where you served in the Rural Development Club, in the Happy Valley Clinic, and in the Medical Students Representative Council. And you were voted by your colleagues as the most likely medical student in the class of 2013 to become the Minister of Health. What inspires your political conscience?
I think I'm just a person who always wants to have a voice, who always advocates for things to be done in the most appropriate way. When I started, and I had no clue what was going on in politics when I started in medical school, and I had no interest, to be quite honest. But when I saw that being part of the movement and decision making, you can impact on those decisions that are being made. So I think that's where the interest started. I just wanted to be the part of the individuals that create change and make things better. And that certainly was just it. And I just learned more and I was more interested. I served in the Happy Valley Clinic, as you've mentioned, the Rural Development Club. And those times were quite just fun. And I think a lot of young people need that those experiences in becoming leaders and just to become better individuals, especially when they go into the working environment. You must just take every opportunity that's given to you. Yeah.
Well, that is indeed thoughtful advice as we celebrate Youth Month. I'll run the risk of getting into trouble for saying this, but there is a certain sense of entitlement among the youth. They enter the workplace and want to be made director tomorrow and don't want to put in some of the hard hours and do the hard yards. Now, when you look back at your path into medicine, what enabled that pathway for you?
Just to take a step back and just remember, I think when I was in high school, I was more interested in computers. I actually wanted to be a computer engineer. And that was my goal. When I finish matric, I'm going to varsity, I'm going to do computer, and I'm just going to be doing science and engineering, and that was it. But when I was in, I think, grade 11, there was a time that we went to the local hospital, Matadeni Hospital, and, just seeing what the things that the doctors were doing there, and seeing patients and seeing that there's a way I could help people, I saw that I could explore that side of me. My class teacher as well at that time gave me advice and said, you know, Sadile, you look like you're someone who likes to help people. Maybe you should explore medicine. I wasn't for that idea initially, but, you know, when I started in first year, and I went to started medicine, I realized that there's nothing else I could have done except for medicine. And even now, I'm quite happy and I'm enjoying the time. There are some difficult times, I think, especially now as a registrar. But it is one of the most incredible fields that one can be part of. You can change people's lives every single day. And that's something that you cannot, take away from the profession.
Indeed, Dr. Kubeka, I don't think you can actually place a monetary value on that, a sense of purpose that it gives one. And at the same time, a very challenging time given the COVID-19 pandemic that we're all engulfed by. Given that you volunteered much of your time providing free medical treatment and advice to rural communities attending the Happy Valley Clinic and the Matadeni Hospital, what have you learnt about the healthcare needs of poor rural communities that you might use to help them if you were made Minister of Health one day?
Well, such an interesting question. Just to give you some information as well, just my interests are it's critical care and rural health. Those are my two that are closest to my heart. And just having said that, I did some reading, I think about 2 years ago, just comparing public and private healthcare and looking at the rural communities. And there was a certain study, I think, that was done and says that it takes about 12 hours for an ambulance to go to a rural community to take someone. So which means that if someone has a heart attack, typically, for example, my grandmother, it can take about 12 hours for her to be, if she has a heart attack. And that's a long time where it's quite different in urban areas. Even if in public and private, so it can take quite a while for them to receive healthcare. There's so many things to consider as to why this happens and that contributes to these issues. So I think there's a lot that that needs to be done. Aspect of healthcare needs to be assessed by the Department of Health and the Minister. And see how can they, bridge the gap between the two. Because if you are in urban health, if we can have the same quality of healthcare that we are receiving in urban areas, I mean, there's something that we can do in rural areas as well. And also just educating people, which it's been done. It's just that we need to reinforce the information and just educate them more and more. It's one of the things that it is a struggle because of how of where we come from, but everyone needs to take a step moving forward and make the difference. And a lot what I've noticed as well, even young people, we expect things to be done for us. But I think we as individuals even in our rural communities, we can make those differences and we can make those changes. I think that idea and that thought needs to be instilled in actually our youth of today.
That idea of locating your locus of control internally rather than externally, I think is truly empowering, Dr. Kubeka. And I just want to come back to your earlier point. 12 hours to get an ambulance to someone in a rural community. Now, you can travel from Joburg to Cape Town by road in that time if you do a bit of low flying. It's just a ghastly statistic. What is the key problem? Is it just infrastructural or is there more to it?
I think the issue is more than just infrastructure. It's multifactorial. And that's why we need to, look into these issues. For example, as I've mentioned as well, I mean, you can talk about infrastructure, but I mean, that phone call might take some time. I mean, it's just a lot more than just one particular issue. It's from the phone calls, it's from the how our hospitals are built and how far they are, and the person who has to, give the message to the people that need to go there, and the person that has to go to the area as well. The vehicle that's being used, there's a lot more than just picking on one issue. So I would just say that the issue is multifactorial, and all individuals that are involved and being part of the system just need to be more involved.
Now, when it comes to COVID-19, there has been an observable difference in attitudes towards the pandemic in rural communities versus suburban communities. And I think it's been multifactorial, to use your word. It was always going to be difficult. Are rural communities understanding the messages of non-pharmaceutical inventions, of interventions, of hand washing, of wearing masks, of physical distancing, all of those things?
I think there has been some change, and with regards to all communities, including the rural community. And the one thing that we have to applaud South Africans is that they've taken this COVID-19 very seriously, and most people are adapting and they're trying their best. I mean, I think the message has been given by the department, and we're getting updates every day. It is a bit of a challenge, but it has affected so many people. But I think most people are trying their best. There's still a long way to go, though, but I think people are adapting. And which is quite unusual for mostly us South Africans, because we find it difficult to change and just do things differently. But people are doing as much as they can. But it's just that it's difficult considering the circumstances that we are under.
You referenced earlier that you're a registrar, and that obviously comes with its own challenges. For viewers, just explain the difference here, because doctors have different roles and responsibilities as they progress through their careers. A registrar is effectively a more senior doctor en route to specialising. Where are you stationed?
At the moment, I'm currently stationed at King Edward Hospital. It's in Durban. It's just next to our medical school, Nelson R. Mandela School of Medicine. I'm currently on my second day of my training. So I've done, over four. So I have to complete about 48 months of training. Yeah.
It's a seriously long road. And why doctors are held in such high esteem, not only the long hours you work, but the long hours put in to reach the pinnacle of the profession. At the same time, it's also a profession that attracts egos. And so it's political at the same time. How are you finding managing those challenges as someone who, when you graduated, was the country's youngest doctor at the time? Have you found mentors easy to come by?
Wow, that's a very interesting question again. Well, with regards to mentors, it's not so hard to find mentors. There's a lot of people that are mentoring me, and I'm grateful for that. And I've found a lot of people that I've approached, and they've approached me quite very helpful and quite receptive as well. But in a way, being young and also having graduated so early, it comes with own disadvantages, and also its own it comes its own specs, basically, and people will treat you differently. You just have to stand strong and be still and be confident in yourself. You might be treated quite differently. I've been treated quite differently Some people I could consider as they are mean to me, but you know, I try my best to just pull myself together. And I think I know that my work ethic is quite acceptable, and I just give it my all and give it my best. And at the end of the day, it's important that I'm there to care for the patients and also to take care of myself. So that's the message I always tell myself every single day.
Well, unsurprising to see why you've come as far as you have with that attitude and perspective. Now, what have you seen on the front lines of the fight against this pandemic? Just recently, we had a story about nurses who feel like it's being on a treadmill of death. How are you finding it?
So when the lockdown started, I was stationed to work in the COVID wards for the first month. So I think a lot of people, when they've been on that side, I think that when everything had started, because it wasn't so much, we didn't have the as many numbers as we have now. It was quite different. And that's why people might have said, no, it's not a strong version of flu. But cases have been presenting quite differently. And you know, patients, some people are stable and some are very sick. So it is important for people to continue with the, you know, the advice that's been given, the social distancing, the hand washing and wearing masks every single day, because you don't know how your body is going to take the virus. So it's quite important to practice as, you know, the safe practices as possible. Having said that, I think the one biggest thing that I noticed, from everyone, whether healthcare workers and people, even the people not on the front lines who are healthcare workers and patients and just any other person, is was fear. Everyone has this fear, and it's so bad in a way that it has affected people, mostly their mental health. Mm. And there's changed the way that people think and the way that they behave and the way that they do things, and it has affected so many people. So I think COVID-19 has been, it almost been a, it's like almost a volcano or something, or an earthquake that just happened. And so it was so unannounced in a way, and people are recovering, and some people haven't even recovered yet, and some people will never recover.
It's actually a very important point that you raise. I recall the World Economic Forum coming out with a paper warning of this second triage wave of public health concerns related to stress-related burnout and health issues because of the mental aspects of COVID-19 and the anxiety and the pressure that you're operating under. What's been done to help healthcare workers deal with these pressures and to provide some level of wraparound support?
You know, I'm going to put myself on the spot for this one as well. When I started, I think when I had to see a patient that had tested positive, you know, it's you may think that you're a strong person and you are, you know, you know, doctors think they're confident, and most of the time you think they are, you know, they some people think doctors don't even have a heart the way that they do things. And the way that they're, you know, it's just a completely different mindset, and the way that you see how doctors behave and their overconfidence. And the first time I was there in that ward, I think I phoned a friend of mine, a very close friend of mine, and I was in tears. And I don't know why I was in tears, but I had this overwhelming emotions, and I was so stressed in a way that I have never been stressed before. I've been under more stressful situations, but I think because of the information and what we've seen was happening on TV, I was just overwhelmed by everything. And having said that, experiencing those emotions, we do not speak up about it as doctors, and we think that we shouldn't tell other people because we'll feel that people will judge us unfairly and they will think that we are weak. And most of the time we try and not show those emotions, and we avoid it, and it piles up and becomes more of a problem at the later stage. And you know, I would say that, you know, Department of Health, the universities, and also just, you know, the public, everyone has been quite supportive towards healthcare workers, and they are providing support. We've been receiving messages, we've been receiving a lot of support from all support structures, and they've sent us even messages to say, if you do need help, you should, you know, come and, you know, counseling and debriefing and all of that. But I think it takes a person as well to go there, yeah, and just accept that they're not doing so well. And most of us, we're finding hard to accept that we're actually not coping and we need some help. And I think that it takes, you know, that individual to also just, you know, be aware of what they're going through.
That said, do your siblings or does your mom worry about your safety? And how do you deal with balancing your personal life with your professional calling at a time when the COVID-19 pandemic has created such a level of fear?
I feel like my family worries more, so I tend to talk less about it. And I always say that I'm okay, even when I'm not okay, because I find them that they will stress more. My mom is 62 now, and my grandma is 83. So I fear for them as well. So that's why I haven't been home ever since this pandemic started, because you have this fear of what if you the person who gives it to them, because I may be symptomatic at this stage. So, you know, those you fear for the worst. And that's what I've also observed from other healthcare workers. You know, the nurses in particular, they fear the most for their loved ones. And I think it is it's a different, you know, it's quite a different world that we live on at this stage. And I think we just have to try and adapt. And me adapting now is to try and speak to them and just be more positive. That's what I've been doing with my family.
Yes, Zooming more than we would ever care to in the strange new world we inhabit. Well, it's Youth Month. We have the world's highest youth unemployment rate. The stats confirmed it this week. What is your message for the youth at this time as we're going through a pandemic, but also a pandemic of unemployment and hopelessness? What would your message to our country's youth be right now?
Well, firstly, I was the youngest doctor 7 years ago. Now I think there's more than enough doctors that are younger than me. That's what I need to say. You know, the one thing that the youth is should be what we invest more as a country. That's one thing. I think the first thing I would just have to say that the government needs to try and invest more in the youth, and know that they are the next generation that will make sure that this country does good in different aspects. But for the youth, I think it takes us back to the beginning of our conversation and saying that it is important as a young person to look into yourself and look that you are, you know, to your capabilities and say, you know, I'm as a person, I'm capable of doing so many things. I'm a leader in my own right, and I can do anything that I put my mind into. So it's important that they just realize that they're more than capable and it is possible. And if I was able to do it at such a young age, it means anyone can do it. And it's just that they just have to keep motivated and just being the best in whatever that they do.
Dr. Kubeka, we salute you and all the healthcare workers out there risking your lives to save ours. Thank you. That was Dr. Sandile Kubeka, South Africa's youngest doctor, born free, sharing his experience of being on the front lines in the fight against COVID-19.